Good afternoon. Well, it's still morning, isn't it? It feels like it's been a pretty long morning. We've been moving across the country. We're in California. We started in California, the cover crop talks this morning, and moved through some pretty tough terrain in North Dakota, and then even worse in Texas, where it's hot and dry, and you can't get enough water to do anything. The only thing I have to say about Texas is you don't have to worry about the tribes from the north of the country bringing their cattle down and removing what little residue you have. So when you run into those kind of environmental conditions in some other countries of the world, there are even additional problems to doing this kind of thing, putting organic matter in soil. And I think it was really great the way this was organized. I've enjoyed it, seeing how problems are similar and different in different environments. And I think that's something that we can all learn from and benefit by to try to understand other environments. I think it helps us understand the environments in which we work in better. Often we have sort of blinders, and everything is just the way we're used to it around home, and we don't often realize that there are these important differences. And, this time I guess I can't move around too much. So I'm going to move through some of these slides pretty quickly. This is not a particularly data-rich presentation, but it does fit in pretty well. I was worried that everybody would be saying the same thing, but so far everybody's been touching on different topics, and the story that we just heard from Tom in Iowa and the Corn Belt region is very similar, actually, to the northeastern U.S. that we're fortunately an area with plenty of rain most of the time, although sometimes ET will get ahead of precipitation in the summer, and you can certainly get some drought periods. But a lot of what Tom showed are the same problems we have in terms of planting windows and temperature and trying to get enough growing degree days in fall and everything. So one thing I'd like to mention is this concept of cover crops. Is, as we've seen, every speaker has chosen a different aspect to focus on. I'm going to focus a little bit more on nitrogen and issues going on deep in the profile. But cover crops really change everything about the system, the biology, and everything else. They're not going to let me do this, are they? So I'm not going to be stuck with this. All right. So cover crops really do change a lot. They enable us to utilize the resources that we have. And I like to think of this when I talk with farmers, especially in a Corn Belt kind of situation where things are even less diverse than in the Northeast. We have quite a bit of diversity. We have large areas of dairy farming, which are, for the most part, corn silage-based. So there's not tremendous diversity, but there's usually some alfalfa in the rotation and some other things in there. And then we have large areas in the coastal plain that look kind of like a sandy corn belt, where we have corn and soybean rotations, but with some small grains, and that opens up a lot of windows. But still, if you're a farmer and you have a truckload of whatever you're growing, there are not too many things you can bring a 20-ton truck to town and sell. You're kind of limited by the market, and that's why there's just corn and soybeans out in the Midwest. And now suddenly the farmer's not constrained by what he or she can sell. You can play around with all kinds of crops, and boy, there's some of the more innovative farmers are having a lot of fun doing this. And you've all seen these types of mixtures that we're going at. So this is just the opposite of this picture. This is actually not in the Northeast. This is in Indiana. But it was a good... Actually, I would have a very hard time in Maryland, at least in my state, finding a picture like this. You can't drive through the corn and soybean region of Maryland on the Eastern Shore and find fields without cover crops. It's just about all green. The state is green. You can see this on aerial photographs. There's still some, but it's pretty green. Late harvested soybeans are kind of hard to do. But you know, this is just such a waste. If you talk to farmers and you say, you know, how many months of the year do you pay rent on that land or taxes? And how many months a year is the sunshine on that land, the water flow, and the bugs in the soil do their thing, a nutrient cycle? And then you think about, you know, how many months of the year are you actually using all those processes? And you look at the calendar, and you've got this annual cropping system, whether it's corn or soybeans, and you really have an active root system, and you really have green leaves capturing sunlight for a very small portion of the year, really just 3 months. And this is another thing a lot of farmers don't recognize, is how much the below ground part of the crop is turned off long before it's time to harvest. So we often think of processes being occurring during the cropping season, and we think of that from planting to harvest, but actually most of the underground processes slow down really when the grain is still filling. So we have planting usually in the Northeast, depending, of course, it gets later as you go farther. So in Maryland, we'll plant early. Farmers will get things in early April, and when you get up to New York or New England, it's about a month later. And you have about 3 months, maybe June, July, and most of August, in which we have a canopy collecting sunlight. We have roots putting out exudates. We have all that crosstalk going on. We have the mycorrhizae that are happy. And then when the grain is filling, the plant says, sorry, guys, we got to think about the next generation. And they stop sending carbon down to the roots, and the roots mostly are senescing, and there's not much going on down there except a lot of senescence and some decomposition. And nutrients start to leak away. So most of the nitrogen is taken up, and it's just being redistributed. So we have several months of pretty warm weather in which mineralization continues, and if there's nitrogen left in the soil, deep nitrogen, it's likely to leach away. Temperatures are getting cooler, evaporation is getting lower, and in our environment, the rainfall is pretty much year-round about the same. So we need to think about how we can make better use of these resources, and by putting this increased biodiversity and some new crops in there, we're kind of filling this gap and doing a little bit better job. It's still not a perennial system, it's not a forest, it's not a prairie, but we're going to get a little bit closer. And this changes everything. You stick a cover crop in there, if you produce any biomass at all, as we've seen from different speakers, we've kind of focused in different areas, but it changes almost everything. And this is kind of a complicated diagram. I wouldn't want to try to explain it all, and there are probably some more arrows you could add to that. But think about what happens when you add this crop either before you harvest or right after harvest. You're now putting cover during the winter, you're adding organic matter, you're adding roots. You can think of this in terms of adding organic matter and food for the microorganisms, or physically in terms of putting cover on the surface. It starts changing everything, the water relationships, the microbial relationships, the nutrients that get lost. And the net, the net of this is that there's much less soil erosion in almost all cases, and it usually has a positive impact on crop growth, or it's going to affect crop growth, sometimes not positively. We do occasionally see some moisture competition, even in a humid region. What you're looking at here is the big corn was in a conventional system without the cover crops, and the stunted corn is suffering mostly from water. And this was a very dry spring in which the water was not recharged in the profile. So this is a risk, but it's a pretty rare risk. Frankly, I've only seen this about twice in 30 years. So it's not something that you should shy away from. This is much more common. Okay, this is midsummer. Plants are going to go into tasseling soon. And if it stays this dry into tasseling, you can pretty much write off the corn crop on the right. You don't have to take soil water measurements to see where the water is on this. Now, this is on the farm of Steve Groff. Many of you have probably known he's one of our leading innovative farmers. I've worked with him for about 30 years, and he's always, even when he was a really young guy, took over the farm from his dad. He was always looking for new ideas and always concerned about soil health. I don't think we called it that at the time, but he was always thinking about that. So I thought it was only fair that we put him in the picture. Took two pictures and blended them together. And you can see the impact here of mixed cover crop on one side and no cover on the other. This is all no-till. He doesn't use tillage on his farm, hasn't in most fields for 20 years or more. So you can have an enormous impact in water saving. This is really due to several processes. It's not just the mulch on the surface reducing evaporation, but it's also, we have measurements in subsoil showing that after rainfall events, if you have biodrilling processes where you have cover crop roots opening channels, that this gets the water down into the subsoil where it's held much more quickly, so we take much better advantage of the rain. We find responses in soybeans as well, where it's unlikely to be a nitrogen effect, even though rye does tend to immobilize nitrogen. We certainly don't have a fertilizer saving by growing rye. I don't know any farmers that are growing rye cover crops and are reduced. Well, I do know a few, but generally we have lots of farmers growing rye and not very many of them, if any, will reduce their fertilizer inputs on that count. But we do have other impacts going on. In this case, we're comparing rye to a radish. These were just single species. And this had a lot to do with moisture and where that moisture was and penetration through compacted plow layers, which we've done a fair amount of work on. So we can often get, 5 or 10 extra bushels. Did I say bushels? I meant an extra half a megagram or so of soybeans, depending on the cover crop. And different cover crops have different effects. In this case, this was from a pretty compacted field. We think that a lot of this had to do with reconnecting the subsoil to the surface soil. And this sort of came up in my mind in a number of things that we saw, including some of the dry regions where, water is all about volume. And if you're restricting crop roots essentially to the surface soil, you're losing out on a lot of water that might be deeper. And we find that there are relationships between the cover crop roots that go down in fall and during the winter and spring, and the number of roots that can get down into the subsoil, in this case at 50 centimeters, so this is below the plow bands, into the V horizon. And this is largely due to the fact that, this is common sense, but I often see people forget about this. Soils are soft when they're wet, right? Don't walk on the grass when it's wet. But you often see people come out with penetrometer, instruments that you push in the soil and measure what the soil strength is. And this is very, very dependent on soil moisture. So it depends on both the strength of the soil compaction and soil moisture. And you can get just about any reading you want if you go out if you go out on a dry day, you're going to find very high readings. So one of the advantages that cover crops has, regardless of species, is they're growing at a time of year, we're talking about fall and winter cover crops, they're growing at a time of year when the soil is generally more moist than it is in the middle of summer. So it's much easier for them to penetrate soil that summer crop when the soil dries down become much harder. This is an exponential relationship. So as the moisture is removed from the soil, clay particles get closer together, the strength goes up exponentially. So that's an important concept with any kind of cover crop. And then we've of course found that tap-rooted cover crops, especially in the brassicas, things like canola, rape, mustard to a lesser extent, and then of course radish, are able to exert more pressure and actually get through soils that others can't. And so we do find that where moisture is limiting, where you have compacted zones, and I rarely go into a cultivated field, even if it's been in no-till for many years, you still find that plow pen down there. You rarely can push in a soil probe and not hit it. If you push it down for 16, 18, 20 centimeters. So we will find yield responses. Usually to almost any cover crop, sometimes it's more cover crop specific. So another issue that's come up a little bit is nutrient cycling, and cover crops can really help with this. I think some of Tom's data was really interesting to see how much nitrate was getting away out of those soils, and we have the same thing. We see some bigger impacts of rye, but generally in the Northeast there's not much tile drainage. On the coastal plain areas where most of the grain is grown, we do have ditch drainage, but not too much tile drainage. But that means, of course, that we have much coarser textured soils with much more rapid water movement. So we are concerned for a long time about the Chesapeake Bay. We had the good fortune of having a crisis earlier than the guys in the Corn Belt, which especially in Ohio, that are being blamed for, 500,000 people being without drinking water for a couple of weeks because of toxic algae. That's the kind of thing that wakes the public up and you finally make some progress. So I sometimes look at the Midwest and I think, well, gee, we were there, we did that 20, 25 years ago because we had some crises in the Chesapeake Bay quite a long time ago. But that's from a public point of view. And we went through a period of time where there was a lot of conflict between agriculture and environmentalists and the public in general, and I think farmers got kind of defensive. But I think we're past that for the most part. I think farms realize that they are part of the problem, but that it's to their own benefit to solve this problem. So these nutrients aren't free. They certainly do a lot more good in the surface soil of your farm and in your crops than they do going through the tile drains or into the groundwater to the Chesapeake Bay or Lake Erie or the Gulf of Mexico or wherever they cause problems. So these are expensive inputs. Even if they're legumes, they still are you're giving up of putting a lot into that, and so that you don't want to lose the nitrogen from legumes and you don't want to lose the nitrogen from manure either. So it's definitely not just a fertilizer problem. And the little inset is showing that we have pretty good relationship between total phosphorus in water and total chlorophyll or algae growth. So I've been working on the nitrogen issues. We have, of course, both phosphorus and nitrogen problems in the Chesapeake because it has different salinity in different areas. But we are trying very hard with cover crops to get a handle on the nitrogen. So the scene in the background here is the field that was on a dairy farm. The silage has been harvested, so there's pretty short stubble, not a lot of residue returned. And on the left, you can see these are actually strips, farm-scale strips with forage radish. And what's graphed here is the mineral nitrogen, the nitrate ammonia, that's in the top 1 meter of soil, and what's in the biomass. And we included the weeds that came up in the no cover. They weren't a tremendous biomass there, but they had some nitrogen in it, 20, 30, 40 kilograms of nitrogen. This is taken pretty much at peak growth before these winter kill in November, all the way up to close to 200 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. And this is just the above ground, actually just the shoot biomass. So in the case of tillage radish, there's probably another 50 or more in the fleshy root. But what I want you to notice here is that the plants took up, there's a 150 kilogram per hectare difference in what the plants took up roughly, but what you see in the mineral soil is only a depletion of about 40. So it certainly doesn't balance. They ask you, what about the other 150? That's a lot of nitrogen to be rattling around. Some of that may have been replenished by mineralization during this growth period. I doubt that much of it was replenished that quickly. This is not a very high organic matter soil. It's a silt loam on a dairy farm, so it has a history of very carefully controlled manure in the last 20 years. We've had first voluntary and then regulatory. You either do or don't want to live in Maryland if you're farming, depending on your attitude. But we're different from the rest of the country. Delaware is a little bit similar. So another possibility is that some of this nitrogen in the plant, we sometimes see 300, even more, kilograms of nitrogen in the cover crop in the fall, and we just can't account for that in the upper part of the soil, but it's possible that it's coming from deeper. So we just started a project. This is another SARE funded project, and we appreciate that, and it has to do with deep nitrogen, deep rooting, and looking a little deeper than we're used to looking. Of course, we're used to looking most of our data, and including in some of the talks this morning, is in the upper 15 or 20 centimeters, right? That sort of standard. So most soil test data is just in this really shallow layer. I would guess probably 95% of what we know about soil fertility and soils in general, including mycorrhizae, is in the top 15 centimeters, and then maybe another few percent in the top 30 centimeters. Very little data to the top meter, and almost nothing in the next meter. Very few. And I think there's actually a lot going on, even in our fairly shallow soil. So many of the soils in the Northeast are formed on weathering rock and old mountain ranges, and the Piedmont of old mountain ranges. And so there's actually a fair amount of bedrock down there, so it forms a pretty clear bottom. So the hypothesis we're testing, and when we do look deep, and it's not easy to get there, we often find a little bit of nitrate all the way down. And just looking at nitrate now, there's also soluble organic nitrogen, which is both plant available and also is algae available when it moves out. And even if it's only 5 or 10 kilograms per milligrams per kilogram of nitrate nitrogen, if you're 10 milligrams per kilogram, that's a fairly low level. But that would be, if you have that much, every 15 centimeter layer is going to have about 20, or 30 centimeter layer has about 40. So you can see that that's going to add up pretty quickly. There's, that's roughly, 40 and 20 and something like that. Pretty soon you're up to the hundreds. We have quite a bit of nitrogen in there. And the way we generally are cover cropping now is that we're putting in after harvest. And so if we're lucky, we get it planted in maybe mid-October. And, the rye takes off, but it doesn't have much growth there. If you measure the biomass, it hasn't taken up much. This is November. And then winter sets in, and it's pretty dormant during the winter. And then in spring, in green up in March, it takes off again. And then, of course, we're anxious to plant our crops, so we don't want to let it grow too long. So we're lucky if we have 50 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare in the rye in spring. I would think probably, Tom, you'd be... that would be pretty high, on the high side, right? Okay, I have to hurry this along. So what we're trying to do is figure out ways to get these cover crops in earlier so we can get fall growth and not rely on them growing through the winter and then doing their action in the spring. Because I think what's happening is this deep nitrogen in the second meter down, say, below 60 centimeters is escaping this fall cover crop. And it's moving on through leaching during the winter. And by the time we do get a lot of root growth and a lot of activity in that month and a half or so in spring, it's gone. And I think we're losing a lot. It's probably gone through the tiles or it's gone down below the rooting. If we can get it in earlier, we do see roots if we have enough growing degree days. And our situation is very similar to what's found, so I don't have a graph of that. But if we can get 600 growing degree days in the fall, we can get this kind of activity. We have to get things planted in early September, maybe late August. So after corn silage, works great. And this is really how radish took off, is the farmers figured that out pretty quickly. I didn't figure it out, but farmers said, hey, you know, I'm harvesting early, I've got a really great window. We can get a couple of hundred kilograms of nitrogen in there, clean up the profile. These roots really do go down to several meters deep, and you end up not even being able to measure the nitrate down there. It's less than a part per million. And then you bring it to the surface. In the case of radish, it winter kills, which is a little bit questionable. What goes on in the winter? Here's a really interesting greenhouse gas question, because I think during the freezing and thawing, it's probably quite a bit lost then. But we do see this being released where the crops need it in the form that they need it in the spring. Okay. So we're hoping that this works. We do actually see this happening. We're going to be going deeper. This is only the top 115 centimeters. But we do see this nitrogen essentially having been pulled up. The green is, the cover crop has been dead since probably January. And this is early May planting time. But that nitrogen is still up here in a silt-loam soil where the corn will be able to get it. And so we see pretty dramatic differences here after rye versus after radish in many years. And this is largely a nitrogen effect, although it's also some temperature and moisture going on as well. This is from some work from Natalie Lounsbury and I. This will be coming out in RAFT's journal pretty soon. This is actually on vegetables, so we have a lot of diversity, quite a few vegetable growers. It's not a huge acreage, but it's a lot of people and a lot of farmers. And we see a definite period of higher nitrate, and the early planted things like spinach or lettuce or even sweet corn can really take advantage of that. And I just want to say this is not just nitrogen. Nitrogen, of course, is environmentally important, but other nutrients are also being cycled up from very deep in the soil and brought back up in plant-available form. So this is sulfate-sulfur, where we've mixed it with oats. We've reduced that. Where we just planted oats, there's really no sulfur effect. So the radish is particularly good at cycling sulfur, nitrogen, boron even, calcium, and also phosphorus. So this is after 3 years of cover crops, a lot of phosphorus stratification, but an increase, not just bringing it up from the surface, but actually I think solubilizing some of the phosphorus. So the brassicas, the green lines are all brassicas, and the blue line is, we see a little bit of this effect with rye as well. We do see considerable reductions in nitrate leaching. So this is early spring, March through April, so corn planting is just about in here. The blue lines are all suction lysimeters from 90 centimeters, nitrate, nitrogen contents, where there was just weeds growing, no cover crop. And even though the radish died several months earlier, it's pretty much cleaned up that profile. I think that's what explains a lot of what you're seeing in Iowa, is that a good cover crop with deep rooting on the years we get that will clean this residual nitrogen, probably several hundred kilograms per hectare, that's accumulated deep in the profile down to several meters. So just a little bit on the policy issue. You get what you pay for. Maryland does have a state subsidy program for cover crops. We pay some pretty enormous rates, make Midwest farmers water. So that's why we're sticking up here. This is the percentage of cropland, and this is from the ag census, but actually it's a little bit higher than that. It's closer to about, it's up in the 30s of total cropland that we have. We have about, I think it's about 400,000 acres. We have the state program, which is voted in by the voters. It's part of their, it's called the flush tax. They actually voted to put a new tax in. This is Maryland, it's not Iowa. They put it on, there was a ballot question, yes, we want a new tax, and you pay for it in your sewer bill. and your water bill, and part of it goes to improve sewage treatment plants, and part of it pays farmers to put rye all over, well, to put cover crops all over. Rye is the most common, rye and wheat. And you can see the more you pay, the more land gets under. This is in thousands of hectares. So we have about 400,000 acres of cover crops in Little Maryland. We only have about 1 million acres of cropland. And we're offering, on average, about over $120 per hectare payments, up to $260. And it's all designed about nitrogen. Different cover crops get different payments. And you can see that there's a list of them here. So we have a problem. The government's always behind the farmers. We don't know what to do yet with the mixtures and stuff. They want to see some data. They will show me the data. And if you plant earlier, you get more money. If you plant on fields that have manure, you get a little bit more money. If you plant in certain watersheds. So we see that this is driving, public policy can drive farmer practices. This is voluntary, but after complaining a little bit, they all are jumping for it. No one wants to miss their cover crop payment. So the downside of this is it changes the mindset in Maryland. So if I cross the line into Pennsylvania, or if I go up to New York, the discussion with the innovative farmers is about soil health and making it profitable and making the system work. In Maryland, it's about, you know, will it fit into the cover crop payment system? This is encouraging early dates of planting. So I just wanted to mention that we have, you know, variety throughout the Northeast, very similar kinds of environmental conditions as in the Corn Belt. And then we need to think in terms of cover crops and what we specifically want them to do. There's the general diversity, which is nice, but there's sometimes some very specific interactions. I can see that Chris is feeling a little uncomfortable with all this talk of brassicas because they're, although they're not the enemy, we actually did some work because we were afraid they would be the enemy of the mycorrhiza, but they're essentially like not having a host for a while. But they catch up pretty quickly. But this is another non-mycorrhizal host. Very interesting relationship here. Spinach just does amazing after a radish cover crop, after it kills, and you can get it in very early. There's an enormous difference in germination, in emergence, and in growth. So I just wanted to leave you with that. You can get some pretty nice responses. I'm afraid it's probably run over.
If you don't, I have a question.
Okay.
Yeah. Radishes. Okay? Often our soils are depleted by the time fall rolls around.
Yep.
Will the radishes roots grow in those dry subsoils?
Oh, are you depleted of nutrients? Oops.
Water-wise. Water-wise.
This is the mic.
Water-wise.
It's depleted. Yeah, that's an issue we're actually looking at. We've got some center pivot tests out this fall where we flew seed on, and we're checking the impact of putting a half inch of water on it. Radish is not going to grow well if you don't have nutrients and water. You need to have a little rain. You don't have to have much water because it'll find water down below. I've seen, and I can show you, rye and radish going next to each other in a droughty fall where you had no rain. And the radish is doing great, and the rye is all shriveled up because it hadn't rained, and the rye couldn't get to the subsoil.
Chris?
Like I said, back then, this has been, we've had this program since the late 1990s. Basically, we had fisteria in the Bay. Hysteria. It was kind of like the incident that happened in Lake Erie. A real crisis, or at least we thought it was. That'll shake up politics. People were getting, there was some memory loss from just being near the water. These were toxic algae. Haven't had it again. But it was a great crisis to make some progress on.
How did that get linked to cover crops, though?
Nutrients in the bay. And the cheapest way to remove nitrogen, to reduce the nitrogen load, way cheaper than improving sewage treatment crops, so we do both, is to grow cover crops. So those, that looks like expensive numbers, But if you can, if we can, if you look at it per pound of nitrogen removed, by the way, it costs more to keep a pound of nitrogen out of Lake Erie than it does to put it on your farm. A lot more. A lot more.
Any comments on interseeding cover crops in corn?
Yes, the question was about interseeding. And in Pennsylvania, they've done quite a bit of work now and developed an interseeder. We've gone through several iterations. It now is a little mini drill down on a kind of a high boy, and it drills three little rows. And some species will do quite well into corn. So far, the experience is in soybeans, it's much tougher. But nobody's measured the light. I've asked several researchers who are doing this. Did you measure the light? They're assuming there's less light under soybeans. I'm not sure whether it's the light. But under corn, interseeding at the side dress time, as seems to work pretty well, and for some clovers and ryegrass and a number of others. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you. And